Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Larson, Judge Werke, Judge Bjorkman, the Honorable Elise L. Larson presiding.
Please be seated. Good morning and welcome to the Court of Appeals. For the audio record, today is September 18th, 2024, and today's argument is being live streamed and we are also making an audio record. The audio record of today's hearing will be available on the court's website within 24 hours. As a reminder, there are no other recordings that are permitted without the express permission of the Court of Appeals. With that, we have four cases on our calendar this morning. Calling the first case, it's case number A24-0066, William Armstrong versus State of Minnesota. Good morning, counsel.
Good morning.
As I'm sure both of you know, you will each have 15 minutes for your argument this morning, and appellants, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Before beginning your argument, please feel free to adjust the podium to the right height for your comfort, and we would appreciate if you would identify yourselves and your counsel for the audio record before beginning your argument. With that, counsel for appellant, are you ready to begin?
I am.
Great.
Normally, I don't have to raise this. Yeah. Down for me typically, but I'm just getting started. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Bo McGraw. I represent the petitioner in these proceedings. His name is William Armstrong. This is a case, a tragic case, about a death of a young child. In the tragic case of a defendant in a criminal case, who has been seeking justice for the better part of two decades. His name is William Armstrong. William Armstrong appears before you today as Mr. Armstrong brought a post-conviction relief petition styled as a motion to withdraw his plea. That was denied based upon a lack of timeliness, according to the district court, and we're here for that appeal. When I said that Mr. Armstrong, at the outset of my comments, is an individual that was searching for justice for the better part of two decades, I can't think of a case that I've handled where basic things have not been a part of his case that fall far short of what would be expected in a case of this magnitude, where we have the protections of the Constitution and we have the integrity of our criminal justice system.
I understand the significance, the seriousness of this case, but you know, let's start out with the fact that you pitched this as a motion to withdraw a guilty plea. And as the district court determined, and as is argued by counsel, this was a stipulated facts trial, so there wasn't a guilty plea. And I just want you to expand on that, because we start out with analyzing whether in fact it's before us as a plea withdrawal.
Yeah, so, and I think that's a complex analysis. I do, and it didn't always have to be this complex, but I think it was this complex in part because of the ineffective assistance of counsel that my client received at the time that he appeared in front of the court and entered into this arrangement. But let's talk about the pieces that were there on that day. What did we have first? We had a plea of guilty. We had a Rule 15 petition that was in front of a court.
Right, but it was made very clear by the court and by counsel that while it was styled as a petition to enter a guilty plea, that is not, in fact, what your client did on that day.
Well, I think the prosecutor did her best attempt to clarify the record after the defense attorney went through this document with my client to lay out how it wasn't a traditional plea. That record...
A guilty plea at all, right? I mean, your client was unwilling to acknowledge the facts necessary to enter a guilty plea, as I understand it.
Well, there was components of an arrangement, though. So this is what I've struggled with. Here's what we know. We know that the county attorney was willing to dismiss count one, which was the most significant charge, right?
Murder one. Yep.
So that came as a part of some negotiation that presented itself in that Rule 15 petition. The other thing that we know is that there were negotiations had as it relates to a sentence. How much time would Mr. Armstrong spend in prison? That too was contained in that Rule 15 petition. We know that that was a part of the record, and then we know that there was a waiver of trial rights. that was also a part of the record. And we all that originated from a document that was entitled Rule 15 Petition to Enter Plea of Guilty in the state of Minnesota. We know that that document was brought to my client's attention. We know that it was read into the record. And we know that my client signed that document. He waived his trial rights according to that document. And it was made known what agreements were made with the state relative to how they were going to proceed and what sentence my client would receive should the court determine that the facts supported the arrangement.
Well, that the facts supported conviction of the offense.
Correct. Correct. Yes. I'm sorry. I sensed a question from...
No. Do you believe this is the thrust of your argument that you need to prevail on this issue before you can... I mean, the other issues all fall into play depending on how we characterize it, right?
So I think if this court says this is... First, you have to make a decision. Is this a traditional plea or is it not a traditional plea? And then away from that...
What do you think are the strongest facts that support your contention or the casting of this as a plea offered to the court? I mean, we clearly see what's on the other side, stipulated facts, the court taking it under advisement, the court saying, I'm going to issue a determination based on the facts. I mean, what facts support that this should be a Rule 15 plea?
So when I think in terms of pleas, we have three components that kind of go into that. Number one, do we have a waiver of rights? Is a person getting something in exchange for waiving his rights to go to a trial or her rights to go to a trial? We had a waiver of rights here.
Well, a waiver of rights to a jury trial as compared to a court trial on stipulated facts. The waiver goes in both sides, right?
Yeah, but we had full waiver. We had a waiver of witnesses. We had a waiver of jury trial. We had a waiver of all those things that we typically see in a plea. So we had a waiver of a jury trial. What did we have next? We also had a discussion about what a sentence imposed might look like. That was buttoned up. That was tight. Everybody agreed. It sounded like that it was going to be 400 months. So we have a waiver of rights. We have certainty as to sentence. We have those two components. And then we had a written document that supported some of these things. But I don't know if we need to get hung up on this point. Because the court said that we weren't timely. We know the rules. If this is determined by this court to be a guilty plea, then... the rules allow, as long as we can establish that manifest justice would occur from not withdrawing the guilty plea, this court would have to analyze whether or not Mr. Armstrong can withdraw the guilty plea based upon the accepted framework that we all know of. Was it accurate? Was it voluntary? What is it intelligent? And then after sentencing, would a manifest justice result should the plea be able to continue?
So but you're saying that rule... How can we determine those questions without a plea colloquy?
Yeah. I don't know if we need to get there. I think we can, if we look at what happened on that day, and we look through that with the framework of, are we talking about withdrawing a plea, or are we talking about ineffective assistance of counsel? What do we know occurred that day? First, I've never seen a case where a person can't get their hand on a file. So we know in the lead up to what happened when my client went in front of the judge on that day to enter into this arrangement, what I'll refer to it loosely as the arrangement, we know that my client met with his attorney.
There's two attorneys, right?
And my client asked to see copies of the files because he said he hadn't seen the files. He asked, what are these motions that you promised on the front end of these cases? Where did the motions get filed? You told me you're going to look for a change of venue and you're going to file that appropriate motion. Did that get filed? You told me that there was going to be investigative services. I've conveyed to you that there's a witness that has come forward and we have a recorded phone call potentially because it was a call from the jail. We have a witness that if you would interview her, you would be able to elicit testimony from this witness that this witness was told by the mother of the child that passed in this very unfortunate situation.
So what you're relaying to me, the import to me is that your client was aware of all of the claims he's seeking to assert now, even before his conviction was final. How can we possibly find that the interests of justice would apply and require us to set aside the 2-year statute of limitations on this record?
So I think, first of all, we have to look at the petition and say, was it frivolous? So what have we laid out in the petition? We've laid out in the petition, first we've focused a bit on whether or not it's a Rule 15 plea and what that looks like under that construct relative to accuracy, voluntary, intelligent. We've laid that out. Then the second part of our brief, we talk in terms of this item that I'm just talking about now, which is the ineffective assistance of counsel plea. So then your question directly, and I'm trying to answer these questions as direct as I can because I appreciate that you've thought of this and you have this question. My client, what makes this case different, there's a couple uniqueness to this case. First of all, the record is clear. He had tried so hard to get his file. He couldn't get his file. He can't get his file even now to get his file, meaning he's reached out to the public defender's office. The public defender's office stonewalled him to get his file. He reached out to the county attorney's office. The county attorney's office did not assist with getting his file. He reached out to the Hennepin County court system to get his file. He couldn't get a file there. And then we know that the way the file was kept, there's questions about that because at the time of his sentencing, and this record is clear, we provided this transcript. The judge said, would you like to exercise your right of allocution? And he said, I would like to exercise that, and I've gone through great care, and I wrote it. And the judge said, I did receive that. So you don't need to read it in the courtroom, but I'm going to make that a part of the court record. We could all pull up the court system right now on Mensis, and we could see if that right of allocution is a part of that record, and we'll find out that it's not.
Well, and again, my question is, in light of all of that, in light of the fact that your client was complaining about ineffective assistance and not having access to the record, at the time he entered into this agreement to proceed with a stipulated facts trial or a guilty plea, as you want to deem it, but either way, he knew about that at the time of his direct appeal, and certainly at the time his conviction became final in 2007. Given that, how can we conclude that the district court abused its discretion by finding this post-conviction petition untimely?
I think it's a fair question. My answer to that question is that he might have had some level of an awareness about how he was experiencing justice in our system. Keep in mind, this is an individual that appeared in Hennepin County District Court charged with first-degree murder and second-degree unintentional felony murder with a zero criminal history score. This is a person that this was all new. He had no experience in the criminal justice system. He doesn't have a file. He's told that he's going to give a right of allocution. It's going to find its way into the court file. The reason that's important, Your Honor.
Explain to me why. What is the? I understand the importance of right of allocution, but what does that have to do with his petition for post-conviction relief? What is the significance of that in terms of the relief you're seeking today?
Because he outlined in that right of allocution the concerns that he had about the way he was being represented at the time. That's why it's important. He talked to the court in that right of allocution about his experience with the criminal justice system and how it fell short for him. So my answer to the court's question about if it became final in 2008 or 2007 and now we're here in 2024, tell me how that goes together. How that goes together is this. There is not anybody that has the ability to bring legal claims forward to a court and have an attorney assist them if they're not able to have access to a file. So it has to start, first of all, with him seeing a file and processing that file to see whether or not he even has claims that he can bring forward and spend the treasure necessary to hire an attorney. Here's the other thing that I think is relevant to this, and this is clear from the sentencing transcript. There was discussions about him being upset with the way his case was being handled, and then they talked in terms about whether we go forward at that stage and what your future might look like, and there was discussion, and he was told that he would have to bring these issues in a post-conviction relief petition. He talks about in his affidavit that we provided to the district court that's made a part of this record, that quest. He talks about reaching out to his mother, who's in a whole other state, to try to gain access to his file. He talks about reaching out to multiple attorneys to try to gain access to his file. He talks about at one point hiring Barry Voss to assist him in post-conviction relief petition and then Mr. Voss becoming disbarred. This is not a person that sat on his hands for the better part of two decades to try to vindicate the death of this individual and to vindicate his rights. He needed to have something to do this from. I think sometimes when we come up here, and I know this court has a healthy respect for what these defendants go through, but I fear that sometimes in our system of justice, we don't quite know how restrictive incarceration is and how limited these folks are in their ability to find individuals that can stand up in a courtroom and make arguments for them. They don't have the treasure. They don't have the ability to contact people. And in this case, when they haven't even had the ability to form conclusions in their own mind that are supported by the file about what some legal relief might look like, it's almost an impossible task. And this is why we have this backdrop. So to get to the bottom of your question, why do we have the delay? Why is the delay? I asserted why I think the delay is, and I think it's supported by the facts that are before this court. But what's wrong with putting these matters on for a hearing? Let's flesh out what happened here. There's ineffective assistance of counsel the way my client views this case. And it fits nicely under both of this analysis. Whether we're ruling,
and the ineffective assistance is the failure to present the witness. What was the name of that witness?
Patricia Doyle. Piggybacking, because my question to you is going to be, Doyle was questioned by the attorney at least on several occasions, and if the attorney found the witness to be of no value to the defense, what is the ineffectiveness there?
I'm not sure that's clear. I haven't seen a witness statement in that regard, but I'll accept that as true from the court. So how that would be resolved is my client takes an oath to tell the truth. We go back in front of the district court judge, and we have a
But he knew all of this. You filed this in 2023. I mean, he knew all of this as the proceedings have been before the court, or he could have brought those to the court's attention.
And my client was clear with his attorney that this witness would testify that the mother of this child had told this witness that she, in fact, harmed the child, and that it was not my client that harmed the child. And my client told his attorney to investigate that, and it's not clear to me from the record that after my client made that statement to that attorney that there was investigation done as it relates to Ms. Doyle to see whether or not that, in fact, would be her testimony. Mr. Armstrong would take an oath to tell the truth today that would be her testimony.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Nicholas Kimball, Assistant Hennepin County Attorney, and I represent the respondent, State of Minnesota, in this matter. The post-conviction court acted well within its discretion when it summarily denied the petition on the grounds that the petition was time-barred with no applicable exception, that it was procedurally NAFLA-barred, and most of the claims were barred by both the procedural bar and the time bar. The post-conviction court did not get to the merits of the case, but as I addressed in the brief, the petition also lacks merit. Now, the main thing I wanted to touch on today was the time bar, because this is a petition for post-conviction relief that is subject to the time bar. Whether this court chooses to accept appellant's characterization of this as a motion to withdraw a guilty plea, which it was not, even if that's how we characterize it, it is still must be brought in a petition for post-conviction relief that is subject to the time bar.
Although counsel makes much of the fact of the mandatory, the shall language in Rule 15.05, Subdivision 1, that requires a district court to let someone withdraw a guilty plea in the event that it is that the plea effectuates a manifest injustice. I think suggesting that there's a different timeline or no time bar applies because it's a Rule 1505 issue. Do you agree with that?
I do not agree with that. Rule 15 also includes itself a timeliness requirement. Rule 15 talks about a timely motion to withdraw a guilty plea. And this court, the Court of Appeals, Weitzel v. State, 883 Northwest 2nd, 553, Supreme Court case, Minnesota Supreme Court, 2016, told us that's A petitioner seeking to withdraw a guilty plea after sentencing must raise the request in a petition for post-conviction relief. The another case, Lucier v. State, 821 Northwest 2nd.
But does that case say that the two-year time bar applies, or are you inferring that the two-year time bar applies because it has to be brought in a post-conviction petition?
So in Lucier v. State, okay. The court in footnote 2 said, quote, "We reaffirm that a motion to withdraw a guilty plea made after sentencing must be raised in a petition for post-conviction relief, and the timeliness of such a motion is treated the same as the manner in which delays in filing petitions for post-convictions relief are treated." So the petition is subject to the time bar.
So then in this case, the real issue for us is whether the interest of justice exception to the two-year time bar is implicated.
That is my position, and that's what I wanted to touch on here today. And the interest of justice exception is the only exception raised by appellant. It's my position that this court doesn't need to reach any other issue, that this court can affirm the summary denial of the petition based solely on the fact that there is no exception, the interest of justice exception does not apply. And there's three reasons that it doesn't apply. And I'll also point out just one other case that is instructive before I get into these reasons, and that's Brown 863 Northwest 2nd 781, Minnesota Supreme Court case 2015. There the court affirmed the summary denial of a post-conviction petition based on the time bar and said that the claim of the interest in justice exception lacked any factual basis, and said that the defendant in that case did not explain why he waited 13 years to file the petition. A lot of similarities to this case. Now again, there's three ways that appellant has failed to meet his burden of establishing that the interest of justice exception applies. And I'm happy to get further into any of them. I'll touch on each of them briefly. First, he hasn't established that any of the reasons that he has given to explain the delay actually caused the delay. And as this court knows, the interest of justice exception requires the appellant to show that some injustice caused the delay, caused him to miss the filing deadline.
Do you respond to the argument that a defendant is not in a position to file a post-conviction petition until they've received their full file and have an opportunity to evaluate that file to determine whether or not they have good claims or not? So I, just assuming for the sake of argument that appellant is correct, that he was never able to actually get his full file.
He still doesn't have the file. And here we are arguing an appeal on a post-conviction petition that was filed. So he was able to file, he was able to hire an attorney and file the petition in 2023 without the file. And I didn't hear during counsel's argument, how in 2023, while still not having the file, he was able to file the petition. So not having the file didn't cause the delay. Not having the file is a claim, an allegation he's making to support the substantive claim in the petition.
So what you're saying is he still could have filed and at that time said, I don't have a file.
As the court pointed out, he complained about not having the file before being convicted, before being sentenced.
So back to 2005, he asserted the lack of the file, so he could have brought his request then and said, I don't have a file, instead of waiting until now in 2023 to say, I don't have a file.
The claim would have been the same then as it is now, as it's substantively written now. And he complained at that point about not having the file. He complained about an alleged failure to investigate, which again is a second reason that appellant has put forward as the reason for the delay, that the ineffective assistance of counsel based on the failure to investigate. And again, this is these.
So is it your position that a defendant should have to use post-conviction relief as a manner of getting discovery over their own file? That kind of seems like what you're saying is that he could have filed a motion for post-conviction relief after his conviction, said, I don't have my file. Then there could have been some amount of discovery and he could have gotten his file to then support his post-conviction petition at a hearing? I mean, is that, because it would be hard to prove or to support an ineffective assistance of counsel claim without your file. I don't think you probably disagree with that.
So that's not my position, and that's sort of, I guess, separate from what I'm trying to articulate. My point is that the not having his file is an allegation that he's making to support the claim that his waiver of rights was not knowing, was not intentional, was not voluntary. He's saying, how could I make a knowing waiver of my rights when I didn't know what my file said? So that is a substantive claim for attempting to withdraw this stipulated facts trial, or this guilty plea. If you want to call it a guilty plea, it's a reason that his guilty plea wasn't knowing, and that's the substantive claim. So this not having the file is an allegation relating to the substantive claim, is not impacting his ability to file the post-conviction motion. So I'm making no statement about whether somebody should have to file a post-conviction motion to get their file. That's probably not right. But it's sort of separate from the point that I'm making, which is not having the reason he's asserting this idea of not having his file is to support his claim that his waiver wasn't knowing. And that's directly from appellant's brief.
But you don't disagree that there's also an ineffective assistance of counsel claim?
There is an ineffective assistance of counsel claim separately that seems, to my reading, to mostly relate to this alleged failure to investigate. And as was put forward in the response to the post-conviction motion and also in my brief, it's just factually not true that Patricia Doyle was not interviewed, was not investigated. She provided three separate statements to the state's investigator. None of them, in none of those statements did she say that the mother of the child did this. She provided some helpful comments to appellant's case. She also provided information that was not helpful to appellant. So there were three separate interviews.
Is this information that would have been in the defendant's file?
I don't know.
Okay.
But the point is, none of these reasons that appellant has put forth to explain why he missed the filing period by over a decade actually are reasons that would have caused him to miss the deadline. The one reason is this idea of one of his attorneys being disbarred. Now, under some circumstances, that absolutely would be a reasonable reason that somebody would assert the interest of justice exception. We just don't know anything about this claim. He hasn't asserted, he hasn't explained when he actually hired Mr. Voss. He hasn't explained when Mr. Voss was disbarred. He hasn't explained, it was at some point after the conviction, but we don't know what Mr. Voss was working on. We don't know when that occurred, and if that occurred at a time that was during the window where he could have filed the post-conviction petition. So if he's working on it in 2006, working on the post-conviction petition and then gets disbarred, and then he misses the window, now that's a reason that he would have missed the window, but we don't know when any of this occurred. I believe the disbarment occurred in like 2014.
Is that in our record or not?
It's not in our record. We just don't know anything.
Is that the reason why you would have a hearing, I guess? I mean, is this the kind of information that needs to be submitted? Is this the kind of information that needs to be submitted with the petition, or would this be a reason for having a hearing?
I believe petitioner would have to submit, would have to make the allegation, would have to make some sort of claim that a post-conviction court could look at and accept as true.
This happened during the time period,
correct,
for example.
Correct. So my first point was that none of the reasons stated are actual reasons that he would have missed the filing period. The second reason he has not established, met his burden of proving that the interest of justice exception applies, is that he has to file the petition within 2 years of knowing about the basis for the exception. And he hasn't established that at all. We know that he knew about not having his file. We know that he knew about this alleged lack of investigation before he was even convicted, before he was sentenced, 15 years ago. That is not, and he filed this in 2023. So he didn't file the post-conviction petition within 2 years of knowing about those bases. And on the third, the disbarment issue, again, we just don't know when that occurred in the record. There's nothing to, and it's petitioner's burden to prove that this exception applies to his case. So the lack of information about Mr. Voss's representation shows that the appellant has not met his burden of proving, establishing that the exception applies. And then
Does the record indicate when Mr. Armstrong became aware that one of his two lawyers was married to someone in the Hennepin County Attorney's Office? Do we have any notion of when that awareness date is?
The post-conviction court, in its order, said that they weren't able to figure that out from the record. My understanding, I believe there is an affidavit from Mr. Armstrong that is in the court record where he says that he found that out from Mr. Voss.
Okay.
But again, we don't know when Mr. Voss was representing him. We don't know what year that was. The court, the index of the case shows action on the case, letters that Mr. Armstrong was writing to the court and others up until 2020. And then there's nothing from 2020 through the filing of the post-conviction petition in 2023. So anything that occurred up until 2020, which was more than 2 years before the petition was filed. And my last point is just that this is just not, appellant has not established that this is one of those exceptional cases where an interest of justice exception should apply. We are nearly 20 years after this tragedy occurred to reopen this case, to bring these victims back into court. This is just not the extraordinary, exceptional case where the interest of justice exception should apply. The post-conviction court acted well within its discretion in summarily denying this petition, and this court should affirm that ruling.
I don't see any other questions from the bench. Thank you, counsel. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes.
So what do we know about the court file that exists between when Mr. Armstrong was sentenced and the time that I got involved and we brought this action forward? We know that it went up to the Court of Appeals. We know that then it went to the Supreme Court, and then we know it went back to the Court of Appeals. Then we know the district court file went silent with the exception of one thing that continued. Numerous letters from Mr. Armstrong sent from his incarceration begging anybody that would listen for a copy of his file. So we know that occurred. And then when the court asked questions about the importance of the file, I can tell this court, as an officer of the court, that the first time my client saw the information about Patricia Doyle being interviewed from the county attorney's office, he's informed me that that was a result of me bringing this petition on his behalf. He had never seen those before. That's why that file was so important. Why are we here now? That seems to be the question. He served 21 years of incarceration. He is scheduled to be released in January of 2026, 16, 18 months away. He sat down all this time. He probably puts himself at risk if this court says, yeah, let's withdraw his plea. Could he be tried again on a first-degree case? Probably could be. He's here because he wants his rights vindicated. They weren't vindicated. And he does so at his own risk. And I would be remiss if I didn't leave you with this. The other reason that he wants to be here, and he told me this the first time I talked with him, he did not kill this child, and he wants justice for Kyle. That's why he's here. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel in this case. This case has been submitted, and we will issue an opinion in this matter in the time prescribed by statute.